Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Before we begin today's show, I just want to let you know that some of the content might be triggering and will be inappropriate for children. We are spending the hour talking about the brave survivors who brought down Larry Nassar after almost three decades of abuse. He will spend the rest of his life in jail. Today's guest, award-winning journalist Abigail Pesta, has written an incredible new book that elevates the voices of those survivors. It's called The Girls, An All-American Town, A Predatory Doctor, and the Untold Story of the Gymnasts Who Brought Him Down. It tells the story of a small town in Michigan, small town gym, I should say, in Michigan, where Larry Nassar honed his manipulations on generations of aspiring gymnasts as young as six. The first known survivor speaks publicly for the very first time. In the book, we also meet Olympic coach John Gettert. He committed verbal, physical, and psychological abuse and worked together with Larry Nassar to keep girls locked in a cycle of manipulation. Gettert is currently being criminally investigated. So how was Larry Nassar able to abuse hundreds of girls for nearly 30 years? Over the decades, many women and girls came forward to share their stories with counselors, coaches, and even police. But they all believed Nassar's lies. Abigail Pesta also reveals behind-the-scenes details of the high-stakes match that led to a $500 million settlement for survivors from Michigan State University, one of the many places where Nassar abused girls. It was the biggest settlement ever of its kind in the U.S. Abigail Pesta is an award-winning journalist. Her reporting has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times and the Atlantic, and her latest book is called The Girls, An All-American Town, A Predatory Doctor, and the Untold Story of the Gymnast Who Brought Him Down. And Abigail Pesta joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Hi, Abigail. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for spreading the word about these brave women. You know, they told their stories to help people recognize the signs of a predator, and they need to be heard.
Well, thank you for writing the book. It's very disturbing, but so important. And this book is a work of reporting based on interviews that you conducted with 25 survivors of more than a quarter century of abuse and manipulation at the hands of Larry Nassar. And many of the women that you interviewed are publicly sharing their accounts for the very first time. You also spoke with family members, coaches, and many other people. But when we're talking about the girls, the women, the survivors, how did you connect with them? How did you get them to talk to you?
Well, it's a very good question, because these were such personal stories. You know, it's really hard to put yourself out there to tell the world about, you know, just devastating experiences you've had in your past. And so it was really just a process of, you know, talking with people, finding out what they were comfortable with sharing. And all along I told them, at any time, if you feel like you don't want to move forward, that's fine. And I told them I would send them their stories before we published them. And again, if, you know, if they weren't comfortable, if they didn't want to do it, that was fine. Because it's a big deal. And I don't know if people think about what it means when you share a story like this with the world. Because, and I spoke to some of the women about this, you know, it means your kids are going to read about it online. You know, everyone's going to know something about you before they even meet you. If you go out on a date and you get Googled, if a boss Googles you before you go for a job interview, they know something about you before you've even met them. You know, so it takes a lot of courage. And like I said, everyone shared their stories because they really felt like they could use their, you know, diabolical experience to help other families, other girls. They thought maybe they could turn their past into something good for the future. And they really do have such groundbreaking insight into how predators operate and how we can know the signs in the future.
I have to say, it was very disturbing to read their accounts. They really told everything. And you know, again, I want to let people know that this might be triggering and might be inappropriate, or is inappropriate for kids. I remember reading about Larry Nassar using his hands on these girls, but I did not know that he actually did rape some of these girls until I read your book.
Yes, the very first survivor who told her story for the first time in this book revealed that she first met Nasser back in the late 1980s. That's when he first set foot in a gym in Michigan where he began decades of abuse, and he started testing limits on her from the very beginning. And she was a prime target. She had just broken her sternum and her ribs. She was trying to come back from this injury. She already felt completely trampled psychologically by her abusive coach. So he zoomed in on her right away, and she revealed that he raped her in his apartment. She had repressed these memories for decades, and, you know, she describes what it's like to be an adult and to have this realization come crashing back into your life. She's in her mid-40s now. She's raising kids of her own. And, it was a powerful revelation. And he went on then to abuse hundreds of girls. He would penetrate them with his hands without using gloves and tell them that it was a medical treatment. And these were kids. They believed him. He was the doctor, and he rose to become the Olympic doctor. So they were honored that he was treating them. But as you said, some kids did realize they were being abused, and they did report him over nearly three decades to coaches, to counselors, to the police, and everyone believed Nasser.
Well, let's just go over some basic information for those who, know about what happened with Nasser and these gymnasts. But let's just give people some basic details. So as you report in your book, some 500 women have now come forward against Larry Nasser. So 500. And as you report, throughout the 90s, so many women and girls stepped forward to report the unconventional, quote, treatment practiced by Nasser. They alerted coaches, counselors, trainers, even police, but they all believed his lies.
Yeah, it's devastating when you hear these stories. Starting back in the 90s, for instance, a teenage gymnast named Larissa Boyce, she reported Nasser to the coach of Michigan State University, because Nasser, he also worked there. Nasser was everywhere. He was volunteering in this gym in Michigan. Then he became a gymnastics team coach at Michigan State, and also doctor at Michigan State, and a doctor for the U.S. national gymnastics team, and then the Olympic doctor. So back in 1997, a teenager reported him to her coach at Michigan State, and the coach, Larissa said the coach just gaslighted her. The coach didn't tell her parents what Larissa had reported. She didn't tell authorities. She told Nasser. So Nasser then sat down with Larissa and convinced her that it was a medical treatment and that she should be ashamed for doubting him. And she was a kid. She thought, oh my gosh, I must have a dirty mind. And she felt guilty. And she said she hopped back up on the table to prove that she trusted him. And she said he abused her worse that day than ever before. And that, that's one of so many stories. A few years later, another young woman went with her mother to the police and reported him. And the police interviewed Nasser and did not interview any outside experts, did not check with anyone else to see if the so-called treatment was legitimate. Instead, they just believed him. Case closed. that was decades ago. But what's so interesting, too, is that now, I spoke to both of these women, and they described, what it feels like to realize decades later they had been right as kids. And, one told me she felt like at first she didn't want to believe the accusations against Nasser because she wanted to believe it had been medical. She didn't want to believe she had been right as a teenager and that, maybe decades of abuse could have been stopped. And the other, the police actually ended up apologizing to her recently for completely blowing it. But for both of them, it's been, just such a psychological struggle to deal with the fact that they were right as kids and adults told them they weren't. And you know, now they're thinking back and, you know, just dealing with a lot of emotional struggles because of it.
As you write in The Girls, if anyone had listened and believed, this predator could have been stopped much sooner. Hundreds of girls could have been spared. So in November 2016, Michigan Attorney General Bill Shute announced a first round of charges of criminal sexual conduct, noting that this was just the tip of the iceberg. So this time around, the police took action. What changed? What happened then?
Yeah, it's so interesting. So back in the fall of 2016, the Indianapolis Star newspaper ran an expose about abuse in gymnastics and about how USA Gymnastics, the governing body for the sport, had mishandled reports of abuse at the hands of coaches. And a former gymnast named Rachel Denhollander read that report, called the Indianapolis Star, and said a doctor had abused her, Larry Nassar. And then two other gymnasts called. So three gymnasts called the Star after that report, reporting Nassar. The Indianapolis Star ran a story, and this time, I think partly because of the timing, it was 2016, people were more aware of this kind of thing and more inclined to listen to women. And just, you know, their great journalism and the bravery of these gymnasts who came forward. Police started interviewing, the women filed police reports, and more women came forward, and it, you know, this time something happened.
And Nassar pleaded guilty in federal court to child pornography charges in July 2017. In December 2017, he was sentenced to 60 years in federal prison for possessing child pornography, images so disturbing that Judge Janet Neff said during the sentencing, they were, quote, like none other that I've seen. And then the historic courtroom phenomenon, as you report, grabbed the attention of the world. 200 women in January 2018 stood up and confronted Nassar in person one by one. And we'll talk about that during the show. And after that happened, the judge, Rosemary Aquilina, sentenced Nassar to 40 to 175 years in prison, telling him, I just signed your death warrant.
Yeah, that was, she really made this case personal. It was a phenomenal development in the case to have all of these women stand up and, you know, you saw their faces, you saw their names, you saw them on the news, on the nightly news. And I think, you know, the case had been going on for some time, but it wasn't until people saw these women that it became really personal. But what I think people also don't realize is that I think a lot of people think, well, once the women stood up and had their say, that this was over. And, you know, that was just not the case. It was just beginning for these women, because acceptance of what he had done was just the beginning of a new phase of dealing. So many of them told me that, you know, they were grappling with, you know, feeling self-doubt and self-blame, and they blamed themselves, and they thought, why didn't I know? And, you know, the blame is on the predator. But this is what predators do to people. They make them doubt themselves. And some women didn't even realize they had been abused until after they saw the women stand up. And then these repressed memories and realizations came back. And, you know, they're dealing with that now. And what was also interesting was when Nassar was first arrested, a lot of women who he had abused, they didn't initially believe the allegations against him. They wanted to believe he had given them a medical treatment. You know, the women I talked to, they grew up with him, some of them since they were toddlers in Michigan. They knew him so well, they thought he was their friend. He had become a master at befriending the kids and their parents, the entire family, the entire community. They trusted him, and they couldn't see him as a predator. You know, he had abused some of them with their parents in the room. He would block the mother or the father's view. And he knew it, that the kid wouldn't say anything because, number one, the child probably wouldn't know it was abuse. And it was embarrassing and awkward. And he knew, you know, also with a parent in the room, the child would then think, well, it must be okay, my mom's here. So that was a long answer to your question. But my point is just that courtroom scene was phenomenal because it really made the case personal. And for the women to be able to confront their abuser like that, I know, you know, it was just a tremendous empowering moment for them. But it didn't mean by any means that it was over.
Larry Nassar will remain behind bars for the rest of his life. And as of your writing the book, dozens of officials have been ousted or charged with crimes. Just a couple examples. At Michigan State, President Lou Anna K. Simon is out, along with the Dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine, Dr. William Strample, and gymnastics coach Kathy, is it Clages? Mm-hmm. All have pleaded not guilty. John Engler, an interim president of the university, is out, along with general counsel Bob Young, Scott Bluckman, chief executive of the U.S. Olympic Committee, and Steve Penny, president of USA Gymnastics, are gone. Penny is facing criminal charges. He has pleaded not guilty, and Congress is probing the institutions. Throughout the book, Abigail, you write, "I contacted this university or this department or this person, and it sounded like almost none of them got back to you, or if they did, their attorney sent you a very generic sentence."
Yes. Well, whenever I report on someone who is accused of wrongdoing, I like to give them a chance to comment, to defend themselves. What I found is that the people accused of wrongdoing really were just hiding, and they haven't talked to anyone, which says a lot, you know. There was especially one who so many of the gymnasts told me about, and that was the coach you mentioned, John Gettert. He worked with Nassar at this gym in Michigan for decades, nearly 30 years. And the gymnast told me he created an abusive coaching environment where they were afraid to tell him if they were injured because injuries were their fault. It meant they weren't concentrating and they weren't focusing. So, you know, one gymnast told me she trained and competed with a broken leg and a broken elbow. And she had gone to Nassar and complained about the pain, and he just taped her up and said she was fine. And she was afraid to complain about the pain to her coach, Gettert, because she'd get in trouble. So she told this insane story of how finally she could no longer train on these broken bones. And at a practice, she was unable to do her floor routine. And so the coach embarrassed her. He told her she had to do the routine substituting somersaults for flips in the air. And he gathered all the girls around to humiliate her, and her sister was among them. And her sister said it was mortifying, you know, seeing her older sister crying, doing her routine with somersaults instead of flips, totally humiliated. You know, this is the kind of environment that this coach created. So when the girls went to Nassar, you know, he was there with open arms being their friend and their confidant. And but there was more, too. The very first survivor told me that the coach witnessed her sexual abuse and did nothing. Well, he did do something. He made fun of her. She said that Nassar was icing her chest after she had broken her sternum, and that he began touching her nipples while icing her chest. And she said the coach walked in and saw this and made fun of her breasts. And he made fun of a lump on her chest from where her ribs had reconnected badly. And he called it her third boob. You know, that's the kind of environment these kids were growing up in. Another woman told me that Gettert had initiated, he had started grooming her when she was 16 for a sexual relationship when she was 18. And that goes against the code of conduct of the Olympic watchdog, Safe Sport, and it left her, in the end, devastated to the point of feeling suicidal because she had trusted him. You know, this was a man she had been taught to trust and obey. So a lot of the gymnasts told me they want to see him held accountable.
This part of the book was so disturbing, just learning about what these girls go through. And to talk more about Gettert, about John Gettert, this Olympic coach. We're talking now about Sarah Turisti, who may have been Larry Nassar's first victim, survivor, I should say. Nassar abused her more than 800 times. But since we're talking about Gettert, Just to throw a couple more stories out there in your book, this is Sarah talking. She said that John Gettert intimidated young gymnasts, ruling by fear. He would throw clipboards at the girls if they messed up. He would call them worthless. Her first experience with his temper came when she was trying to do a round-off back handspring back tuck. She took off poorly and ended up landing on her head, getting a rug burn on her face. He was supposed to spot me, she said, but he was angry that I started off wrong, and so he turned his back and walked away. And, I mean, this just went on over and over and over. He said, "You're not trying, you're useless, you're lazy." At one point, he threw like a 40-pound item at her, and then he made fun of her. He mocked her. He made sexual jokes with another coach. She had a defect in her legs, so they curved outward. He said the boys would love her because I couldn't get my legs together. She was only 10 when he said this.
Yeah, I mean, and I heard so many stories like this. It was, you know, it was so eye-opening and so devastating, because you could see how over the decades, because the women I interviewed ranged, you know, from Sarah, the one we're talking about now, she's in her mid-40s, and she was Nassar's first target, and his very last target, Emma Ann Miller, she's in her mid-teens, you know, so over the years, I heard gymnasts and women, you know, not everyone in Nassar's universe who he abused was a gymnast, but many were. And they told me about how this coach and this doctor together created this abusive environment. And just, you know, they said Gettert was a prime enabler. And what's so interesting, too, is that today, so Sarah, you know, when she saw all the women stand up in court and these repressed memories of the childhood sexual abuse came back, she said she still blames herself, you know, because it had been so drilled into her head by Gettert that injuries were her fault, that she thinks back to this moment, this instant when she was falling from the balance beam, and something flashed through her mind, which, you know, telling her you should adjust yourself to land better. And she didn't. She thought, "I'll be fine landing in a pit of foam blocks." And she looks back to that instant and thinks, "You can never let up. You know, you have to stay focused." And she lost focus for, you know, a split second and landed badly. And that angered her coach, and that sent her to the doctor's lair. And she blames herself. And, you know, when I was talking to her about this, I said, "If you heard someone else tell you this story, you would tell them it's not your fault." And she said, I know, but in her own mind, that's what she's still wrestling with. And that goes to show, when you take a kid, and some of these kids started as toddlers, and you have a coach like that, you know, who the women described it as brainwashing, basically. They just wanted to please the coach, that they were kids and this was their world, and they wanted to do better, and they wanted to get their coach's approval. And, you know, if you have a coach who's more of a dictator than a coach and blaming kids for their injuries, this is, you know, these are the kind of lifetime effects that it can have.
And before we go to break, one more story about Sarah Turisti and her coach, John Gettert. She talked to you about moving into a new space that didn't have air conditioning, and it was really hot. And so they work so incredibly hard. And so she was trying to stay cool. And after 5 or 6 hours of practice, the heat got to her. She felt really dizzy. So she asked a coach if she could go to the bathroom. And what she wanted to do was basically lay down on the floor so she could get a little bit of coolness on her body. John came into the bathroom and said, "You're faking it. Get up." She said he always walked in on the girls in the bathroom. If he noticed you were not in the gym, he would go searching for you in the bathroom. So here's this grown man walking into a bathroom where a 10-year-old is trying to get a little bit of respite from the heat. So when I read about John Gettert, Abigail, you know, it just made me wonder, and I don't know if there's any way of knowing this, but how many John Getterts are out there?
That's the scary thing. You know, when the book came out, I gave a talk at the National Organization for Women in New York, and, you know, a gymnast contacted me afterward, and she said she had been there, and that she had been a gymnast growing up, and she was in gyms all over the country because her dad was in the military, and she saw this time and again, and she's now looking to do something about it and becoming an activist. And that's the terrifying thing, is that it is happening everywhere, and that's where these stories, I think, are so powerful and so important, because no matter what the sport is, these parents, they were paying attention. Mm-hmm. They were not the ones pushing their kids into this. That was very interesting to me, too, because you have that, there's that sort of notion that, well, the parents must be the one forcing their kids into this. Everyone I talked to said they wanted this. And these were girls, like I said, in Michigan, who they didn't necessarily have Olympic dreams. They wanted a college scholarship, and they set their sights on that. And, they wanted to keep going. They wanted to improve and excel. So they were the ones pushing themselves. And the parents, they were there. I remember the mother of one of the most recent survivors, a teenage girl. She was 16 when I interviewed her, Autumn Blaney. And the mom was there at the practices. She was there at the competitions. She was there. She went, her daughter went to train at the Caroli Ranch, the famous Olympic team training center in Texas. Parents weren't allowed at the ranch, so her mom would stay at a hotel nearby, and they would talk. She would talk with her daughter at night on the phone until her daughter fell asleep. She was there, and yet she didn't know her daughter was being abused. But that's why these stories are so important, because over the decades, when you hear these families talk about how this predator emerged and progressed and developed his skills, he had decades to do that. You can see the red flags, you can see the signs, and know what to watch for in the future.
Today we're speaking with Abigail Pesta. She's an award-winning journalist. Her new book is called The Girls, An All-American Town, A Predatory Doctor, and the Untold Story of the Gymnast Who Brought Him Down. After a break, we'll talk about where John Gettert is today. We will talk about parents, and then we'll also share more stories of the brave survivors who stepped forward to share their stories, some for the very first time, and ultimately they brought Larry Nassar's reign of abuse to an end. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the future of the U.S. economy and what we need to know about the inner workings of the economy. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. You can find past shows and sign up for our podcast. And if you can, leave us a review, yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Abigail Pesta, an award-winning journalist who is out with a very important book called The Girls, An All-American Town, A Predatory Doctor, and the Untold Story of the Gymnasts Who Brought Him Down. And if you'd like to join today's conversation, if you have a question or comment for Abigail, if you spent time as a gymnast, or if you did any work around athletes, especially young girls or really even boys, what are your thoughts about what we learned about the Larry Nassar case and the fact that so many young girls and women came forward for almost three decades, but everyone believed Nassar? And then later in the show, we'll talk about what has changed for athletes across the country. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. John Gettert, this abusive Olympic coach, worked with Larry Nassar for nearly three decades. They also worked together at the 2012 Olympics, where they served as team coach and doctor. He is being criminally investigated today. What does that mean exactly?
Well, the Michigan Attorney General is investigating him, and the Attorney General has not specified what exactly the investigation is about, but I can tell you that it began after the Michigan police began investigating him after the Nassar sentencing hearings, when various gymnasts stood up and started speaking in court about John Gettert. So they were giving their victim impact statements in the Nassar hearings, but they were talking about this environment that they had grown up in and about Gettert's abuse. So after that, Gettert was suspended by USA Gymnastics, the governing body for the sport, and then he retired, and the police investigation began. So it's been going on now for more than a year and a half, and again, they have not specified what exactly they're investigating, but there have been many complaints in court and in my book about the abusive coaching, the enabling, and as Sarah said in my book, the outright witnessing of the abuse decades ago.
John Gettert's wife, Catherine, she is still running is it Twistar's gym?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah, I was really surprised, you know, and I went to see the gym, and you kind of assume no one would be going there anymore after all of this. And yet, you know, I did see there were kids there, and it was, you know, I have to say, I was thinking if I had visited that gym a few years earlier and seen all these girls and their leotards and their ponytails, and they were so young and they looked so enthusiastic, and I would have thought, oh my gosh, how wonderful. You know, I did gymnastics as a kid at the girls club in Indiana, and I would have thought that was so cool. And here I was now looking at this gym, you know, through completely different eyes and seeing these girls, and I just had this dark feeling. But yeah, so the gym, so John Gettert has retired, his wife is running it, and you know, kids are still going there.
I mean, this was kind of shocking to learn that his wife is still running it, because she was around. I mean, I don't know what if she saw the physical abuse, but for sure, the verbal abuse, saw John throwing things. I mean, he did this sometimes at meets. And at one point, she actually took one of the girls to the hospital because her injuries were so severe.
Right. Yes, that was Sarah Tristy when she broke her sternum. You know, she described trying to get back up on the balance beam. She had fallen, she'd broken her sternum, and she tried to get back up on the beam because she was afraid of getting in trouble. And in fact, she said Gettert asked her what was taking her so long. And so she tried to get up, and then she passed out, and then, yes, his wife brought her to the hospital. So, and she was a coach at the gym as well. So, you know, it's not only, you know, the women, the gymnasts who grew up with us, who reported these kinds of things, but sometimes the parents saw it too. And there was one parent who said she confronted him. If, you know, she confronted Gettert if she saw him yelling at her daughter or acting inappropriately. There were a lot of witnesses to what was going on at that gym. So, you know, I can't speak for how it's being run now or why it's still running, but that's the case.
Abigail, let's spend a little bit of time for people who maybe never did gymnastics or don't really have personal experience with gymnastics, just to give people a sense of how it is all-consuming for so many young girls. The foreword of your book was written by Tasha Schwickert, a U.S. Olympic team medalist, and Jordan Schwickert, a U.S. national team member. And they write, "By our early teens, we had climbed to the elite level. When we made the U.S. national team, the training got toxic. We spent a lot of time at the Caroli Ranch, the official training center for the national team in Texas. We dreaded going there. The coaching was all negative, verbally and emotionally abusive. It was a terrible, threatening environment, all about power and control. As soon as you stepped into the gym, you became a robot. You were not allowed to be exhausted, to be human. You turned off your emotions. If you got injured, the coaches made you feel useless, so everyone hid their injuries and kept training, taking medications to mask the pain. We saw girls get so tired, they nearly landed on their heads while doing skills, yet they were ordered to repeat those skills again and again. None of us had a voice." So if this is the official training center for the national team, this just says so much about how abusive this entire system at least seems to me, based on what so many of these girls shared in this book.
Yes, and actually that the Caroli Ranch has been closed down, so that is no longer in operation. But yes, Tasha and Jordan, they had such a good perspective because, yeah, they experienced this from the highest levels of the sport. Tasha was an Olympic medalist, and, you know, they too were ensnared by Larry Nassar because he would go to the Caroli Ranch and treat the national team and the Olympic gymnasts there. And, you know, I remember Tasha saying, and with both Tasha and Jordan, also they didn't realize until after his arrest that he had abused them too. And they both described what it's like to be an adult realizing you were abused as a child. And I remember Tasha saying it was so hard to wrap her head around because, you know, they had been taught to be so tough as gymnasts. And, you know, she said she saw herself as this impermeable African-American athlete and no one could take advantage of her. And to realize that someone did, you know, was devastating. And she said she kept blaming herself and that she was working with her therapist on that to try to get beyond that idea. And she said, too, that she, you know, in one of Nasser's many manipulative tactics, he would make the gymnast feel special. And he offered to treat her for a week, to have her stay with him for a week at his home in Michigan with his family. And he would treat her during that week for an injury, a heel injury. And she said he abused her 3 times a day, morning, noon, and night, mm-hmm. under the guise of medical treatment. And yeah, so to look back and realize that's what was happening, you know, it's devastating. But yes, a lot happened. You know, a lot of abuse happened at that ranch, at that training center in Texas. And that was under the umbrella of USA Gymnastics. You know, one gymnast, she was also a 3-time national champion, Jessica Howard. She told me USA Gymnastics sent her to the ranch specifically to be treated by Nasser, not to train, but to be treated for a hip injury while he would be there for a week. She said she was by herself, of course, because parents weren't allowed there. She was completely isolated. She knew no one. No one was watching out for her. So, again, like, perfect target for Nasser. You know, she had been also trampled by a coach who was, you know, hard-driving and abusive, and she felt, you know, kind of mentally beaten up, and there she was on her own. She described it as being like on an island that you couldn't escape from, and she, you know, had to see Nasser for a week there. You know, years later, she wound up so depressed from the situation. She ended up in a, you know, her sister helped her check into a psych ward at a hospital, and now she's, you know, a leading advocate for children in sports, but again, yeah, it's all, you know, these girls were not protected.
Did most Olympic athletes train at the Karole Ranch?
Yeah, it was the official training center for the national team and the Olympic team.
Wow, so they all had to endure this kind of abuse.
They did, yes. And the Olympic gymnasts have come forward as well.
It's just incredible. I mean, you would never know this if you're so many people love watching the Olympics. The sport is just these people have these, you know, superhuman skills. I mean, and these girls are in these beautiful outfits and their hair is perfect with their makeup. And to think that behind the scenes, they had to endure so much abuse is really shocking for people who, you know, like I said, don't have much personal experience with all of this.
Yeah, the culture of the sport and the coaching in the sport, it really, this is what so many gymnasts told me, it must change, because whether you were training as an Olympic gymnast or as a kid in the gym in Michigan, you were taught to fall in line, to be quiet, to not complain, to not talk about injuries. Injuries were your fault. You know, it was this kind of brainwashing, as they described it, that they grew up in. And, you know, I wanted to point out, too, that a lot of the women I talked to were the ones who did grow up with Nasser in Michigan in this small-town gym. And, you know, they have such profound insights into his evolution. And they said that they felt like, you know, they hadn't been heard or they had been dismissed because they're not famous. And it really pained me to hear that, because the insights that they have to offer, they watched him evolve. They watched him figure out how to befriend kids and parents. They saw him bringing Olympic pins and gifts back for the kids from the Olympics. And then he learned, you know, when social media came around, how to text them and like their posts on Facebook and Instagram. And like over the decades, they saw him evolve, and they describe all of his tactics. Or like he wouldn't bill the family because he wouldn't bill the family's health insurer because he said he saw such potential in their child. And then they would look back later after they realized the truth and think, oh my God, he didn't bill our health insurer because there are no medical records. You know, no one could see what he was doing. So there are so many lessons in their stories, and they're so important So again, I really appreciate your helping me spread the word.
Today we're speaking with award-winning journalist Abigail Pesta about her very disturbing but important book, The Girls, An All-American Town, A Predatory Doctor, and the Untold Story of the Gymnasts Who Brought Him Down. And you can join us if you have a story to share, a question or a comment. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Since this ranch, the Caroli Ranch, was the official spot, the official training center, can you just talk about the various levels, the people, the institutions that had to have known that this abuse was going on? And what explains it? I mean, what kind of profit are these institutions, the U.S. Olympics? Can you talk about the profit margins, how much money we're talking about here?
Well, you know, there was the gymnast who I just told you about, Jessica Howard, the one who was sent to the ranch for a week when Nasser abused her while she was by herself. She went on to serve on the board of USA Gymnastics, and she saw from the inside what this organization was like. And she described a place where she would go to the board meeting. She was on the board. She was supposed to be an athlete representative, and she imagined that she could change the culture of the sport and that she could convey the concerns of the gymnasts to the board. And she said she quickly realized that's not what they wanted at all. She said the board meetings consisted of, you know, video montages of girls winning medals and discussions of sponsorships and lucrative deals. And she said everyone went out for fancy meals on the organization's dime. And she said one time she remembered a lawyer coming in to address an abuse case. And he said, "Don't worry, we've got it covered financially." And she said she realized, oh, it's not about the athletes. It's about covering their asses. And, you know, so she ended up quitting the board and getting therapy. But time and again, you hear these stories, especially at Michigan State, where Nasser also worked. He was a gymnastics team doctor and a professor. And he also worked in a sports medicine clinic there where he got his hands on people across the community. Well, Michigan State got busted for outright covering it up. In 2014, a woman named Amanda Thomashaw went to Nasser, and he abused her, and she knew it, and she reported it to Michigan State and to the police, and she just got gaslighted. You know, she was told Michigan State issued two reports, one to her that said Nasser had not violated the school's sexual conduct policy, and then an internal report that said, yikes, major red flags here. We could have major legal liability. We need to keep an eye on this doctor, and they put certain restraints on him, which he then did not obey, and no one oversaw him, and now his boss is going to jail for that. But, you know, that was nothing short of a cover-up, and it's so sad because instead of looking out for the people that their professor, their doctor was treating, they were looking out for themselves. So yes, they then eventually had to pay $500 million as a settlement to the survivors. And there's an interesting story too there that you referenced earlier, which is one of the lawyers representing the survivors in the case, James White, he told me this phenomenal story of how, you know, Michigan State had legal immunity as a state institution. So he started working on a bill with state senators to try to strip the university of immunity. And he stayed on it. He paid attention. He was watching to see how the vote would go with legislators. And when he realized that the vote was not going to go his way, that Michigan State was going to retain its legal immunity, he called his band of lawyers. He was working with lawyers from across the country on this potential settlement and said, make the deal now. And they did. And he said Michigan State didn't know it would have had immunity, and they made the deal for $500 million.
Wow. And just one quick story. We're going to get to a call in a minute. In 1997, Larissa Boyce came forward to report her abuse. She went to the head coach of the Michigan State gymnastics team, Kathy Klages, sitting in her office. Quote, I told her in detail. I said, his fingers are going inside of me and it feels like he's fingering me. The meeting did not go well. The worst part was Kathy's reaction. Larissa said she felt interrogated, then publicly humiliated as the coach called other gymnasts from the youth program into the room in pairs or in groups of three, asking if they felt uncomfortable with treatments from Larry, and Larissa had to sit there embarrassed. Just quickly, Abigail, because we have a phone call and a couple emails, where is Kathy Klages today, the head coach of the Michigan State gymnastics team?
Well, she has been arrested. She is accused of lying to the police, and it's about, in fact, that incident, because she told police she was unaware of the abuse, and Larissa and another gymnast from the time said they told her about it. So she's under arrest and awaiting trial.
You have to wonder how many other people approached her, given that that was back in 1997. Let's go to a phone call. Let's hear from Sarah in Santa Cruz. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Thanks for covering this topic. I just wanted to mention on the subject of abuse of gymnasts in general, that back in 1995, the San Francisco Chronicle sports writer Joan Ryan wrote a book called Little Girls in Pretty Boxes, The Making and Breaking of Elite Gymnasts and Figure Skaters. And she specifically talked about the abusive methods of Caroli, about the abuse he used. And yet it was even after that that he and his wife have been so involved with USA Gymnastics. And I just wanted to mention that because people have been aware of at least that kind of abuse since back in 1995.
Yeah, thank you. And we were talking earlier about just how shocking it is that John Gettert's wife is still running a gym today. So as Sarah said, Abigail, I mean, this has been going on for decades. What would you say has changed today? I mean, when we're talking about the main training center for future athletes, what is going on there?
Well, the Caroli Ranch has closed. But yes, yeah, Sarah raises a really good point that it has been going on for decades. And, what I hope is, and what these women who spoke with me hope, is that, you know, by their speaking out, this is how things will begin to change. And we have seen dozens of officials get fired or charged with crimes from USA Gymnastics, the U.S. Olympic Committee, Michigan State University. And Congress recently proposed a law to give Congress some oversight over the U.S. Olympic Committee and USA Gymnastics. So there is some progress. But, you know, the gymnasts all told me there's so much there's so much more needs to be done. And, you know, for instance, accountability of the coach who they say was a key enabler for almost three decades. They want to see him be held accountable. I think some progress is being made. I spoke with Valerie Condos Field, the beloved UCLA gymnastics coach who recently retired, and she had worked with a lot of Olympic gymnasts on her team after they won medals. And she said one way to think about it is what we can do ourselves. And she said one thing we can do is, if you're a parent and your kid is in a sport and, you know, your kid comes home and you say, did you win? You know, she said you can ask them, how did you perform today? How did you feel about your performance? What did you learn today? And she said we can kind of start changing the dialogue at home. And I thought that was really interesting, too, that, you know, as a society, we place so much value on winning. And she said she had grown up in dance. She was a professional dancer, and the focus was not on winning, but on performing to the best of your abilities and learning and growing. And that was the message that she, you know, used in her coaching. And she said these elite gymnasts would come to her, and they were shocked when she would say, what do you think you need to work on? Or, you know, how do you feel about your performance? She said they thought it was a trick because they had grown up in these, you know, abusive environments where they had no autonomy. They had lost all sense of self and, you know, personal boundaries. So anyway, I thought she had some really valuable insight. It's you know, things that we can do, but it's, you know, big picture, the coaching needs to change. You know, she said, you take a little kid and you have a coach, and they will think that coach is God. They will do anything for that coach. So you need responsible coaches.
Wow. I just want to end the show, Abigail, just quickly talking about Chelsea Markham, who was among the girls who told someone about the abuse. It happened in 1995. She fell from a balance beam in a gymnastics class in Roseville, Michigan, injuring her back, and her coach recommended that she see Larry. So her mom, Donna, began driving her for appointments several times a month. We don't have much time to go over her story, but I just wanted to end with her because she was so incredibly depressed by all of this that she ended up taking her own life in 2009.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and her mom, she just gave a heartbreaking victim impact statement, and I followed up with her later, too, and she said, you know, it took so long. It caused so many problems within her family, you know, within her marriage, with her other daughter who blamed her for the longest time, and they've only recently come back together. And I think her story is so important because it shows just, you know, the ripple effects across families, you know, with this, when you have this kind of childhood abuse.
Well, Abigail, it's a disturbing book, but it's so important. Thank you for all the work that you did to put it together and to elevate the voices of these girls and women. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rose.
Abigail Pesta is an award-winning journalist. Her latest book is called The Girls, An All-American Town, A Predatory Doctor, and the Untold Story of the Gymnasts Who Brought Him Down. And you can read excerpts of Abigail's book at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Kevin Vance for producing today's show, and thank you so much for joining us. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar.